Les colloques du Collège de France.
First of all, thanks a lot to the organizers for putting this paper on the program. It's been a wonderful day and I really enjoyed it, so I'm very happy to be up here. Hopefully I won't lower the general level. So this is joint work with Jan Eberly and Dimitris, who are my colleagues at Kellogg, and then Andrea, who's at UCLA. So the starting point for this paper is that intangible assets are an important factor of production for firms. So just to fix vocabulary, what's intangible asset? It's a term from accounting that refers to productive assets that don't have a physical presence, so you can touch them. Usually that covers three groups of assets: IT-related assets like software and databases, IP assets like patents and trademarks, and then other corporate assets which include production processes, management methods, as well as customer or supplier relations. Now, in the literature that's looked at intangible assets, there's kind of a broad permanent question, which is what's special about these assets? And there's two lines of research. One is the measurement's really hard. And that might be, that's since we're here in honor of Zvi Grytics, this is probably the thing that Grytics could have emphasized. In fact, he contributed some papers to this literature. This literature says, well, the flows and stocks of these things are really tricky to figure out, so that's what we should focus our effort. But when it comes to putting these things in economic models, we can treat them essentially just like we do physical capital. Another strand of research says, no, these maybe have distinct economic characteristics that make them different from physical capital. So with apologies to Grytics, this paper is going the second route, not the measurement route. So I'm going to discuss a model that, in which we emphasize some distinct economic characteristics of intangible capital with an application to basically recent trends in the US economy over the last three decades. So what are the two things we emphasize in this paper? We emphasize the following idea, that intangible assets are assets that can be, to an extent, non-rival within the firm, and to an extent as well, non-exclusive between firms. Now, these words are a little loaded and fuzzy, so let me just describe what I say in words more precisely what I mean. So non-rivalry first. At their core, most intangible assets are some form of information about production. So it could be information about a product design, a production process, it could be information about a customer base, and so on. Now, once a firm has figured out that information, it can codify it, replicate it, and share it within its divisions so as to service, for instance, different markets. So if you take a concrete example of, say, a search algorithm, that's a set of instructions on how to crawl the web. You can codify that into software, and then you can share that software for your firm to service different markets. And you can do that without having to pay, again, the investment costs that led to the creation of the algorithm in the first place, so the R&D and so on. That's quite different from, say, if you need an extra truck to service a new market, then you have to pay the full investment cost for the truck again. Now, exclusivity, that's a little easier, is just the idea that it can be difficult to prevent other firms from also using the asset. If the search algorithm leaks, it might be difficult to stop competitors from embedding it in their own product offerings. So what we're going to do in this paper is going to attach a structural parameter to each of these properties. So rho is going to be for non-rivalry, lambda for non-exclusivity. And the reason we're going to do that is because we want to think of them as being sort of on a continuum, not just black and white. So non-rivalry, I want you to think about as something about technology. In particular, how easy is it to codify and therefore replicate knowledge assets within the firm? So it might be quite difficult to do when all you have to go by is, say, writing. But as you go, as technology advances and we can now use, say, digital supports to codify knowledge assets, maybe that becomes easier. Non-exclusivity, though, I'm going to think about having to do with the property rights environment. So here again, you can think of different systems of property rights around knowledge assets, say patents versus trade secrets. In this kind of broad framework, one could think of different types of intangible assets as being characterized by different pairs of rows and lambdas. Just to fix ideas graphically, on the horizontal axis here, I'm putting this parameter for non-rivalry ranging from 0 to 1. So 0 would be a perfectly rival asset within the firm, say a truck. 1 would be something completely non-rival, say maybe an algorithm. The vertical axis would be the degree of exclusivity. So 0 would be a fully exclusive asset. So I have complete control and cash flow rights over it. And then as lambda gets bigger, I have more limited exclusivity. In many of our models, we put physical capital down here. We have perfectly well assigned control and cash flow rights and a perfectly non-replicable asset. And oftentimes, when we have a notion of TFP in models, say firm-level TFP, we model it as a completely non-rival input within the firm. So if a firm has a certain level of TFP, you can apply it equally well to all users within the firm. And then generally, it's modeled as a public or semi-public good, so it's to an extent non-exclusive. What we're thinking about here is intangible assets as maybe being somewhere in between. So if you think, for instance, of a molecule that's patented and that can be used across a number of drugs within the firm, that would be a very easy to replicate type of knowledge asset and one well protected by say, patent law, the production process might be harder to replicate exactly from one establishment of the firm to the next. It might also be more weakly protected, say, only through non-competes or trade secrets. So the question we're going to go after in this paper is, imagine you have a model that has these features. What happens to growth when the degree of replicability or non-rivalry of assets within the firm changes and when it goes up? And so here what we have in mind is, in words, the idea that something, some technological change, might make the replication of knowledge assets easier within the firm. And the data I'm going to show you will span roughly the early 90s in the US, so think about the IT revolution. The contribution is we're going to write down a long-run growth model where we sort of formalize these two ideas, and then we're also going to discipline that model. So I probably won't have time to do a careful explanation of the quantitative part of the paper today, but in very concise words, we're using data on firm scope, so how many markets or business lines firms have in the US to pin down the degree of non-rivalry in the model. And then we're using data on essentially who owns the firm at entry, so ownership by the founders of the firm, to tell us something about the degree of exclusivity. So if I have time, I'll get there later in the talk. And then armed with this kind of quantified model, we can look at the answer to our question. And the main point I'm going to try and get across is that in this model, when you increase the degree of replicability of assets, you don't necessarily increase growth. And in fact, I'm going to show you that generically the version of the model that I'll discuss today. The opposite is true. So over, in the long run, so in a comparative static sense, if you make things more replicable within firms, where you end up is a situation where entry rates decline in the long run, investment rates decline, trend growth declines, despite the fact that the scope of firms or the number of products they produce or the number of markets they're active in goes up, their profits rate go up, various measures of valuations within the model go up, concentration goes up. And so this happens over the long run. What I'll show you as well is that the transitional dynamics are interesting. They're characterized not by an immediate decline in entry and investment, but instead by a burst. Okay, so this is going to be a model where if you change rho today and permanently, in the short run, there'll be a wave of entry, investment, and a burst of growth. And then in the long term, you'll decline to you'll converge to a lower balanced growth path. So I'm not going to try to give you the intuitions here. That's kind of where I'm headed for the next 10 minutes. But just to give you a sense of why we think this is maybe interesting, well, a lot of these qualitative predictions of the model look a lot like what the US economy has been characterized by over the last 2 to 3 decades. So just to fix ideas, as you guys know, many measures of the profit rates of firms have been increasing. This is the ratio of corporate profits to GDP in the US. Measures of valuation ratios, this is my favorite one, Tobin's Q, have been increasing since the 90s. This is a very Porzmann version of concentration rates across the main sectors of CompuStat that has been increasing steadily since the 90s, and entry rates have been declining. And so our model is going to predict or is going to produce patterns that are qualitatively consistent with all of this and to an extent quantitatively as well from this change in the degree of replicability of assets within the firm. All right, so let me walk you through the model. And here, there's basically two little things that are new here, so hopefully I'm going to give you the intuition of how they work and how they capture these key ideas that I highlighted in the intro. So the structure of the model is super simple. There is a household that supplies labor to intermediate good producers. Two forms of labor. One is production labor that's used after entry by firms to produce stuff, and one is entrepreneurial labor, which is essentially how you start a firm. Intermediate good producers channel intermediate goods to a final good producer and then to the household. All the action is going to be on the guys in orange over there, so that's who I'm going to be talking about for the rest of the talk. So these guys, each of them is going to produce some measure of intermediate varieties, and I'm going to call that the scope of the firm. Okay, so think of X as some number characterizing how many business lines or how many markets a firm is active in. So a firm J, a monopolistic producer J, is going to have a number of decisions to make. The simplest one are what happens after entry. This is a model where essentially everything is decided, or most important things are decided at entry. After entry, all the firm does is it is the monopolistic producer of a particular variety. It has a Cobb-Douglas production function that takes as inputs labor and then a fixed amount of intangible capital. M here is for the particular variety in the product, within those that the firm is producing. And N of M is the amount of intangible capital that firm has allocated to the production of that variety at entry. Okay, so think of that as being fixed once the firm enters. So that's going to give me some profits here. So I'm not going to show you the exact expressions. They're fairly simple. But think of that as a very simple monopolistic production problem and pricing problem. All the interesting stuff is at entry. So at entry, the entrepreneur is going to create a firm that is going to have some intangible capital stock, some total intangible stock, that I'm going to call N of J. the production process for that, I'm going to, where this energy comes from, I'll tell you in a few slides, but for now take that as given. Given that total intangible stock, the firm is going to have to choose two things. One is just how many varieties it produces, that's the scope. And the second one is how it allocates intangible capital across these varieties. Okay. So let me tell you about those in reverse. I'm first going to tell you about the allocation problem and then the scope choice problem. So the allocation problem is going to look something like this. So after entry, the entrepreneur has created, imagine they have some scope and some amount of intangible capital. They've created a firm that's worth something. So that something here is going to be the enterprise value, VT. And that's going to be the present discounted value of future profits. And the profits are basically discounted and then aggregated across varieties. So here you can see everything is kind of nice and isoelastic. This comes from the monopolistic competition problem. I won't give you any details on this. Now, the somewhat new thing here is how we're modeling the allocation problem. So the thing that the entrepreneur has to choose is how to allocate intangible capital across this variety subject to a sort of budget constraint. The budget constraint is unusual in that it says that there's a CES aggregator that has to be less than or equal to the total capital stock N. So I'm going to focus in the next couple of slides in explaining to you why this captures this idea of replicability within the firm, how this rho thing works. So the idea is the following. Take rho equals zero. In this case, what you have is the standard sort of adding up budget constraint. The marginal rate of technical substitution is one between varieties. We think of that as being the case of rival assets within the firm. In a symmetric allocation, say you have 100 units of productive assets, 10 uses for them, you would allocate exactly 10 to each. So this would be how we typically model machines or structures. The other limit case of the CES aggregator is when rho is equal to 1. So there, the technical rate of substitution is 0, and we think of that as the case of non-rival inputs within the firm. In this case, the aggregator converges just to the max. And so in a symmetric allocation, if you have 100 units of productive capital, you can exactly replicate that across each use, so you have effectively 1,000 units if you've deployed it across X uses. So you could think of, for instance, a patent as being an example of that for, say, your touchscreen. Then the cases that we might be interested in are those in between, where the rate of technical substitution is bounded away from both 0 and 1. In this case, we think of it as imperfect rivalry within the firm, and the way to visualize this is in a symmetric allocation, you will end up allocating some amount of productive knowledge to each of the uses, each of the varieties, but that amount will be, say, more than 10. It could be as much as 80 if rho is close to 1. Okay. And so these would be things that are fairly hard to replicate within a firm, say an inventory management process. You can think of Amazon as being an example of, the N here would be Amazon's blueprint for how they organize warehouses in online delivery. And the N over X to the 1 minus rho would capture how well they're actually able to implement that blueprint within each of their establishments. Okay, this little device here gives us a way to think about this notion that you see in the literature that intangible capital has, returns to scale. Formally, what happens in the model is enterprise value is going to be sub Cobb Douglas of the scope of the firm, and it's in total intangible capital stock. When rho is zero, this becomes a constant returns to scale aggregator, but when rho is strictly positive, there's actually jointly increasing returns to the scope of the firm and to its stock of knowledge assets. Okay, so now I've told you how the firm is going to choose how to allocate capital across uses, and I've told you about this device for non-rivalry. The second thing I need to tell you about is non-exclusivity and the choice of scope. So this is basically how the firm chooses how many varieties to produce in. So what we're going to assume is that at entry, the entrepreneur is going to create this total amount of enterprise value, but he's going to have to give some share gamma t of x of that enterprise value, and will only receive the remainder, so 1 minus gamma times v. So the key assumption we're making here is that this gamma is increasing with respect to scope. So what this is saying is that if the firm, the entrepreneur enters and creates a bigger firm, enters in more markets, that's great. They're going to create a bigger pie, but they're going to only get to keep a smaller share of that. Okay, they're going to have to give up more of entry surplus to outsiders. Now, how do we, how does this relate to non-exclusivity? Well, you can think of the lambda parameter here, that we use to capture non-exclusivity as just a shifter in this function gamma. If lambda is zero, then gamma is zero. You have you appropriate all rents from entry. As lambda goes to infinity, you might think of gamma as converging to some upper bound that's strictly positive. But in the paper, we actually provide a micro foundation, and we think of it as the firm or the entrepreneur needing to deter key employees with knowledge of the firm's assets from creating their own firm. Okay. So, you know, the more detailed story here is that at entry, the firm needs to hire some key employees to increase scope. I'm going to call those outsiders. And they have to share some of the key knowledge assets of the firm. But down the road, at some point, these guys might get the option to start a new firm, a competing firm. They'll compete at Acourneau. And you can compute essentially the present value, the expected present value of entry for outsiders of these rights to compete down the road somewhere. That's how much the entrepreneur has to give to these guys to deter them from entry. And so that would be the gamma times V here. And the result in the background is that this share, this option value to compete is proportional to enterprise value by a factor that only depends on the scope. So you can think of the lambda here as capturing, for instance, patents, trademarks, or non-competes. Okay, so I've given you essentially the second key ingredient of this model, and now you can see in this equation that how optimal scope is going to be chosen, because this is homogeneous of degree 1 minus omega plus rho omega with respect to x. The x here is going to solve a very simple optimization problem at entry, and the economics here are very, you know, simple. This term here, it says that the firm chooses its boundaries to take advantages of economies of scope, and these are amplified when rho is higher. But on the other hand, it's limited in its choice of scope by basically imperfect property rights. So if in this model, if you want to become really big, you are likely to expose yourself to a lot of imitation by your key employees, and therefore you have to compensate them more to deter them from doing that. Okay, so these are the key economics. The rest of the model is very simple. One unit of labor creates some fixed amount of intangible capital we're going to build on the shoulders of Romer for how we model the process of total idea creation in this paper, and then labor markets have to clear. Okay, so in the time I have left, I just want to spend 1 minute on explaining to you what's going on with the main comparative static I mentioned in the introduction, and then say a word about data if I have time. So in the introduction, I told you, well, in this model, strangely, if you increase non-rivalry, the degree of non-rivalry, so if you move from our typical assets resembling more cars to resembling more algorithms, you have a declining pattern for growth, and this is the statement about comparative statics, okay, across balanced growth path. Now, in balanced growth, everything in this model is coming from entry. So this left graph is the same thing as saying that entry rates are declining. So what's going on here? Basically, in this model, increasing growth has three competing effects. One is returns to entrepreneurship increase because, you know, even fixing scope, with higher rho, you benefit from being able to replicate your knowledge assets more, so you create more enterprise value at entry. On the other hand, you also create bigger firms. And because this is an economy where the scarce factor is labor, eventually that's going to push up wages because this intangible capital still needs some labor to work with. The first effect is going to incentivize entrepreneurs to create firms. The second one is going to disincentivize it. The third effect is this non-exclusivity effect, which is that as rho increases, you optimally choose to create a bigger firm, but you also have to give up more of that to your key employees or to the outsiders that help you raise the scope of the firm. And that is going to make entry less attractive compared to the alternative in this economy, which is production labor. So if we didn't have the non-exclusivity part, if scope were fixed in this model, these two effects would exactly offset one another, and higher rho would just lead to higher levels of GDP, but no long-term growth effects. On the other hand, if we do introduce this effect, this disincentive effect that I was discussing, the growth is going to be lower in the new BGP. And you know, really what's going on here is these firms are now entering with the better technology, higher rho, they can deploy knowledge assets at bigger scale, but for that they're going to need, you know, lots of computer scientists, lots of IT workers. Eventually that's going to beat up their wages, and they're also going to have to give up more of enterprise value to this group of people, which is going to further disincentivize entry. This is all going to be true even though growth may increase in the short run, so let me show you that part now. So I'm going to go very quickly on this. The exercise we do in the paper is we calibrate the model to the early 1990s, and then we measure the change in rho in the data, and that's the only thing I'm going to show you really. And then we feed that change through to the model to look at what the transitional dynamics following that change look like, and what we get is the result I mentioned in the introduction of a burst of growth. Now, I'm just going to talk about how we measure rho very briefly. Basically, we use recent data by Hubbard and Phillips, who do textual analysis of 10 case statements of US firms. And we leverage the fact that in the model, the covariance between this is a measure of scope, so basically how many product markets a public firm operates in, the covariance between that and the firm's sales is going to help us identify rho. So this is the scope of the typical firm in that data set. The average firm goes from having about 6 product markets to about having about 10 in the late 2020s. I'm going to go quickly over the identification, but if you back out from the cross-sectional covariance between sales and scope, the value of rho consistent with the model, what you find is rho went up from about somewhere about 0.2 in the 90s to now about 0.4. And feeding that through the model, I'm going to skip this, gives you a burst of growth in the short run, followed by a decline. All right, I'm out of time, so let me wrap up. The main point here was to propose a way to think about this notion of imperfect or partial non-rivalry of assets within the firm, how it interacts with non-exclusivity, and ask, you know, how do changes in the degree of non-rivalry affect growth, show you this somewhat puzzling result that in the long run it depresses growth. And you know, this is a setup that you can use to ask a number of other questions, including measurement questions, more in the first spirit of Grytikas. So thank you very much.
So the main idea, to introduce the main idea, let's start from patented ideas. We know that patented ideas are both seen as fully non-rival. The use of an idea by one individual does not prevent the use of that idea by another individual. And fully excludable, patent prevents the idea from being stolen by an imitator and exploited by someone else. However, the main point of the paper is that most intangible capital is both not fully non-rival and only partly excludable. Okay? So, and the question asked by the paper is what are the implications of the degree of non-rivalry and of limited excludability for growth? Okay? In a situation where you don't have full excludable, it's partly excludable. When you vary the degree of non-rivalry, what happens to equilibrium growth? Okay, so the idea, the model is as follows. The economy is populated by entrepreneurs. Each entrepreneur is endowed with a stock N of intangibles, which he can allocate among several varieties or product streams. Okay, and she can choose the span, that means the range of varieties she will produce. Okay, so she will distribute the stock N of intangibles across this X variety, but she can choose the range X. Okay, innovation intensity will be determined in equilibrium by a labor market clearing condition. labor for research plus labor for production equal labor supply, and a free entry condition in equilibrium. You should be indifferent between investing in entry, in innovation, and working as a production worker at wage W. Okay? So now, for given amount of intangible, the entrepreneur chooses her production labor demand, her span X, and her allocation of intangibles across the varieties, across the X varieties, to maximize the value, its value, the value of the firm, subject to this constraint, okay? So that tells you how you spread, you know, the intangibles given the constraint N. And the rho is crucial here because the rho is your measure of non-rivalry, okay? So if rho equals zero, it means that increasing N of M implies that you reduce the N of minus M, okay? One for one. So that's full rivalry. It's zero non-rivalry, okay? But the other extreme is when rho equal one, then this becomes max of N of M. So that means if I increase N of M, I don't have to reduce N of minus M. And that's the case where I have full non-rivalry. And the thing is to parameterize by the degree, by this rho parameter. And the whole thing is how does the growth rate varies with this rho when you have partial non-excludability, limited excludability. Because if you have total excludability, you have no problem. You don't fear imitation. Okay, so it's only interesting if you have partial excludability. Okay, so the value of the firm, in fact, when you solve, you know, you maximize over the x of over the n of m subject to the constraint, the above constraint, you end up with the value of the firm, which has this very nice shape. It depends on x and m, and you see that the higher the rho, the higher non-rivalry, the higher, the more desirable it is to have a higher scope. You see what I mean? It's you have, if you had rho equals zero, you would have constant returns in x and n, but when rho is positive, you have increasing returns. Okay. Alors, so if it was only for that, you say, well, okay, I would like maximum scope. I would like to have the maximum n. But in fact, no, you don't, because in fact, there is imitation. And in fact, the value to the entrepreneur is this v of x and n multiplied by this 1 minus gamma, which reflects the threat of expropriation. And the whole point is that the higher the scope, the higher the span of the firm, the more vulnerable you are to expropriation. And that's a force that will play against increasing the scope, the span. You see what I mean? On the one hand, you want to increase the span, everything else, because the V of X and N increase with N. But on the other hand, it plays negatively through that. But of course, if lambda was zero, if you had full excludability, that would not be a problem. You would go for the maximum scope. It's because you have limited excludability that you have this gamma of x and lambda that increases with x. Okay, and that's the key. That's the heart of the paper. Okay, so okay, that's exactly what you have. If lambda equals zero, the gamma is always zero. So then you go for the maximum x. But when lambda is higher, then you have this counteracting effect that a higher x makes you more vulnerable, okay, to being imitated. So the main prediction is you have a non-monotonic effect of the degree of non-rivalry of intangible of the row when excludability is limited. Why? In a nutshell, some water. Hop. It's delicious. Yeah. It's good that I don't have full excludability on water. That's very good. Okay. On the one hand, greater non-rivalry induces firms to increase their span, as intangible can more easily be deployed across more variety. That was this term. That was the V of X and N effect. Okay. Which in turn has the direct effect of increasing the firm's value and therefore encouraging new entry. But now, that's not taking into account the 1 minus gamma part, okay? And that's the on the other hand. On the other hand, the higher the degree of non-rivalry, the more a higher span exposes the firm to the risk of being expropriated by an imitator. For sufficiently high non-rivalry, increased non-rivalry may induce the firm to reduce its span exposed, and therefore it may reduce the maximum achievable post-entry value, which in turn will tend to discourage entry. And that's the counteracting effect. There is a typo there, increase non-rivalry, not increase rivalry. Okay, great paper, very interesting and rich data, very nice model, and very nicely used. Okay, just I have a few comments. My first comment is that a critical hypothesis is that upon being imitated, the entrepreneur loses everything. In particular, she loses both the varieties and the intangible capital she invested in. When Uber Eats copied the geolocalization software for deliveries from Deliveroo, Deliveroo lost rents, but not its intangibles. In the paper, the total stock of intangibles remained constant upon imitation, whereas presumably it doubled when Uber Eats, at least it was not just remained constant when Uber Eats imitated Deliveroo. Maybe the total stock increased. And how would the conclusion change? More generally, how would the conclusion change if the incumbent firm shares intangible with the imitator and or competes neck and neck with the imitator? Presumably, that would introduce an escape competition effect of the type I've been analyzing in my joint work with Blondel, Griffiths, et al., which might encourage more and bigger innovation by the incumbent. Incidentally, maybe you could affect the row through your own choice of innovation strategy. You might decide to make a bigger innovation to escape the row, in a sense. You see, you could decide to play on the row. That makes me to the next comment. Shouldn't row be seen also as heterogeneous across varieties? Here you assume the same row across varieties. But maybe, presumably, the rows vary with the type of things you do. And you may choose, when you increase your span, to pick also varieties which have different rows. And that might change the analysis, okay? You don't choose all varieties with the same row. How can we directly test the predictions of the model? We saw superstar firms since the early 2000s increase their span following the IT revolution. Meanwhile, we witnessed a decline in new firm entry. Are these two parallel trends consistent with the theory developed in this paper? Okay. Finally, my final comment. And in fact, in the work I've done with with Pete, Huey, Timo, and Antonin, the big span of large firms was more like a deterrent to entry. Here, the span makes you vulnerable. In our paper, a bigger span somehow makes you discourages entry. So how can we test who is right? Last comment, software embodied AI is an important example of intangible with limited excludability and partial non-rivalry. Joint work with Ben, Ben, and Chad, as well as recent work by Brynjolfsson et al. And also empirical work I've been doing with Simon Bunel, which Antonin referred to this morning, point at a sizable growth potential of AI. And as we argued in our joint work, AI automates both the production of goods and services and the production of ideas. So we believe that's an intangible that really has a boosting effect on growth. A counteracting force, however, is the lack of competition, particularly in the upstream segment of the AI value chain. For example, the cloud is dominated by Amazon, Google Cloud, and Microsoft. And as we stress in our joint work with Antonin, Huey, Pete, and Timo, in our paper on falling growth and rising rents, I'm done, the IT revolution allowed more productive firms to increase their span of activities, thereby reducing the scope for competition and creative destruction. So how would you bring, what do you think of these effects compared with the type of effect? Isn't that a more obvious reason, counteracting force? But overall, a very stimulating paper, a novel idea, and very elegant and tractable model. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.